You are back with The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Southwest Airlines took a cadre of its top officials to the Big Island. It was to talk story with community leaders and tourism officials about plans to expand service to the Kona Airport. Now, that meeting took place last night, and our Hawaii Island reporter Sherry Bracken was there and is live on the line with us. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine. How are you doing?
Good. So tell us about this meeting. Who was all invited there?
Well, it was community leaders. There were people there such as Will Okabe, the county managing director, and some county council members, Sue Leloy, people who are involved in tourism, head of the Japanese Chamber of Commerce, Steve Ueda, a lot of people who are very involved in the community from all around the island. So it was government and community leaders, travel professionals, hotel people, and even some folks from Hawaiian Airlines.
Oh, interesting.
And it was interesting because it was billed as a talk story, and most of us expected to get some firm details about future Southwest plans, but it really was talk story with the Southwest people who, I have to say, were some of the happiest people I've ever seen.
Happy to be in Hawaii, yes.
I think happy to be in Hawaii, and they shared their views of their employer and how they really feel that the culture of Southwest is very compatible with the aloha spirit of Hawaii. So that was all good, and it was fun to listen to how excited they were, even though some people wanted a little more detail.
Well, what details do we know?
Well, we do know, as you know, they're already coming into Honolulu, and for the Big Island, it's very important. They will start service to Kona Airport May 12th, not direct to and from the mainland yet. They will do connecting flights, Kona to Honolulu to mainland and the other way, and that was great, 4 flights daily each way, because one of the things that's very good for Big Island residents is having a little bit of choice and airline competition and just increasing the number of flights. So that made everybody happy. And initially, they're offering flights as low as $49 between Kona and Honolulu if you book by April 5th and you fly by October 1st. So that'll make a lot of people happy.
Yes, because we know the folks on the Big Island just get socked with, you know, the highest price of gas and you know, longer drives. And so it's nice to see that you'll get a little break on the prices there.
Yeah, that's good. And I'm certain that will encourage Hawaiian Airlines to perhaps give a little more price break, because some of the flight prices between the Big Island and Honolulu get to be pretty high. Now, there were folks in the audience who asked about service to Hilo, and that was really on everybody's mind. And they made a point of saying more than once, well, we're not making any formal announcements today, but we're looking at Hilo. And frankly, when I spoke with Brad Hawkins, who is their communications guy, months and months ago when Southwest first announced and asked if they were going to offer inter-island flight to the Big Island, he said, well, I can't make any formal announcements today, but we are looking at it and we're in the market to stay. So I think everybody took from the way Southwest couched it last night that they're probably going to add Hilo at some point once they get everything together.
Right, get the infrastructure of Maui and Kauai, and then maybe it'll circle back.
Yeah, and they do have some issues. Adam DeCare, their vice president of network planning, told me that they also need to deal with some terminal issues in Honolulu. You know, are they going to fly out of the inner island terminal? Are they going to fly just out of the main terminal? So they do have some operational details to settle.
Well, what is the snapshot for tourism since we had all those natural disasters last year?
Well, tourism is generally similar to what it has been. It is down from the previous year, and Japan coming into the Big Island is our weakest market versus the previous year, and it's taking longest to recover. And I spoke with Art Taniguchi, who's the Honorary Consul General for Japan here in Hilo, and with Ross Birch, who is head of Hawaii Island Visitor Bureau, about that. And it seems that it's mostly because when the lava flow started, tourists got very concerned. They were concerned about the air quality more than anything. And now that the lava flow has stopped and the air quality is superb on the Big Island, there isn't as much to see. You know, there's no active flowing lava. So Art's just made a tour of Japan with Hawaiian Airlines officials and other airline officials, talking with Japan Airlines as well, about helping to boost tourism back to the Big Island, because we really do need the Japanese tourists, not just because they're great visitors and they really want to see our natural resources. And of course, they bring money into the Big Island. But as you may recall, Kona Airport had customs, lost customs, got customs back for the Japanese visitors primarily, and we really need to make sure that we keep customs. So we want to have customs and border patrol here on Big Island at the Kona Airport.
Right, so you want to see people funnel through there to give them something to do.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, Hawaii Volcanoes National Park in 2018 had just over half the number of visitors it had in 2017. In 2017, it was 2 million visitors. And then last year, it was just over 1 million. And you have to recognize Hawaii Volcanoes National Park was closed for almost 6 months.
Right. So the numbers are down, I'm sure.
Yeah. And right now, although the park is open, it's not as open. You know, there's still a few things that are still not fixed there. So that's definitely something that needs to be worked on. And we need the Japanese tourists back.
What did they say about marketing West Coast?
I'm laughing because you may have seen the announcement in the Star Advertiser made by the Hawaii Tourism Authority President Chris Tatum. He talked about a bus tour of the West Coast. And it might be even as we speak. Ross Birch, head of Hawaii Island Visitor Bureau, is in Honolulu going today to talk more about that. Our biggest tourist numbers come from the West Coast. And so we really want to continue to boost those numbers to get the tourism numbers back where they need to be. Ross said that although our revenues were up from tourism about 2% last year, that was not the kind of growth that was anticipated because the numbers were down. So the whole point of the bus tour would be to just remind people what a great place Hawaii is to visit, the Big Island specifically, as well as all the other islands, and they have to work out the details.
Well, I'm sure.
Now, I sent Ross a picture of Ken Kesey's Merry Band of Pranksters bus because that was my vision of the bus tour, and I'm not sure HTA thinks of it that way, but we'll see.
Well, I'm sure they do want to get people out there helping the small businesses that rely on the visitor industry that are hurting.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And as you know, tourism on the east side of the island, particularly Pahoa, is definitely down. And matter of fact, we had a story on HPR 10 days ago or so about Small Business Development Center doing classes with the merchants to try to, you know, improve their marketing to get folks back. But just getting more folks onto the island will help with that because there's still some great places to visit on the east side of the island, including Pahoa Village. So all of that is good.
I know there's lots of talk about an extended Golden Week, so hopefully the Big Island will reap some of that.
We're hoping. One other thing I wanted to mention about Southwest, I spoke with Stephanie Donahoe. She's Kohala Coast Resort Association. And when Southwest first started looking at our island, they came and they met with a whole bunch of people, including Stephanie. Their focus was not, here's what we want to sell you, but what community organizations on the Big Island should we be connected with? Because if we come in, we're going to be involved in the community. And that kind of attitude really was impressive.
Well, I know someone whose relatives actually work with Southwest on the mainland, and they were told by the company that there are no plans to hire people here, you know, to create new jobs and to hire, you know, maybe more flight attendants. But they were going to allow the opportunity for the folks that had Hawaii ties to operate on those routes. So that was kind of good. But did they mention anything about job creation at all?
Not yet. And I think it's mostly because they're still getting organized. You know, they once they got their approval from the FAA, they were in the air 2 weeks later with service to Honolulu. So, no, they did not mention the job creation thing.
Okay, well, they've certainly been talking about coming to Hawaii for a long time, and now they're here.
They are here, and we're happy to have them because, you know, tourism is our number one industry for the whole state and definitely for this island.
Okay. All right. Thanks so much, Sherry.
Thank you. Aloha.
That was HPR's Hawaii Island reporter, Sherry Bracken. You can find her stories online at hawaiipublicradio.org. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. In today's backyard, we take a closer look at some historical footprints. In 1920, fossil footprints of Hawaiian men, women, and children and hoofprints of Polynesian hogs were discovered in the Kau district of Hawaii Island. Now, the prints are in a hardened layer of volcanic ash laid down during the 1790 eruption of Kilauea volcano, and part of their significance involves the volcano goddess Pele, Kamehameha the Great, and the battles for the Big Island. Many historians and Hawaiians believe the footprints were made by a high chiefs, warriors who were traveling with their families. Keoa Ahuula and his company crossed the summit area of the volcano during the eruption en route to battle with warriors of Kamehameha the Great, losing one-third of his army to volcanic gases on the way. For today's quiz, can you tell us who discovered the prints in 1920 while hiking across the Kamoku lava fields? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Blue Hawaiian Helicopters, with tours on Kauai, Maui, the Big Island, and Oahu, celebrating two decades of support for Hawaii Public Radio. BlueHawaiian.com.
For decades, rates of teen smoking were on the decline, but in the last 10 years, there's been an explosion of new products for consuming tobacco products. Now, e-cigarettes and vaporizers flooded the market and ended up in the hands of many children before regulators could catch up. More than one in four Hawaii middle schoolers have tried one of these products, some of which contain as much nicotine as an entire pack of cigarettes. 80 students from six islands are rallying at the state capitol this afternoon in support of two measures that would further restrict the sale of e-cigs. HPR's Ryan Finnerty spoke with Trish Lachica from the Hawaii Public Health Institute about this growing problem.
So in Hawaii, we're experiencing a youth vaping epidemic. So this is a rise in e-cigarette use among our teenagers at the middle school and high school level. We're seeing that teenagers who are trying e-cigarettes, statewide it's at 42% for high schoolers and then 27% for middle school. Regular use, though, is 25% for high school and 16% for middle school. This is, you know, double, almost triple the mainland rates. But even at the national level, the Federal Food and Drug Administration, the CDC, they've been sounding the alarm as well on the vaping epidemic. They've just seen a surge in youth use where in 1 year's time, from 2017 to 2018, youth use of vaping has shot up by 78%. And so there's 1.5 million youth who are more youth who are vaping now than they were a year ago.
And Trish, do we know how that compares to adults? Are there similar trends for adult users of these products?
The adult vaping rate is 4.7%. And so it's a stark contrast to what we're seeing with the 25% of teenagers that are using e-cigarettes.
Is there any indication as to why youth are picking up this habit at such greater rates than adults are?
Yeah, I mean, if you really look at cigarette use, you know, cigarettes are not, they do not come in tasty and sweet-smelling flavors. Youth are not attracted to these products. And we've experienced, you know, at least in the last couple of decades, just all the progressive laws that have been passed around cigarettes, and we're lacking that. There's been a big gap with e-cigarettes for policies passed in the state. And that's what we're hoping to really do is be able to regulate them in the same way as these tobacco products, because vaping products are still, you know, tobacco products in under state and federal law. They contain nicotine, which is derived from tobacco plants, but there's still no tobacco tax attached to these products. There's still no licensing or permitting component to be able to sell these products. And, you know, they're still able to sell them online and market them, you know, in a very attractive way.
Trish, I know that for decades, smoking rates had been declining, especially among youth. And do we have any idea what has led to the reversal of that trend?
Yeah, I mean, we think that it's no coincidence that the rise in youth use of vaping products has been in conjunction with the explosion of sweet candy-flavored tobacco products. And if you look at it, vaping was virtually non-existent a decade ago. We did not see this infiltrating our schools and our homes, and youth weren't picking up these products, you know, in the large numbers that they do now. But we see products that are available in flavors that seem like they belong in a candy store or an ice cream shop, right? You see peanut butter cup, cookies and cream, cotton candy, gummy bear, and there's over 15,500 flavors on the market right now, and that's crazy, and it still continues to grow. And when the tobacco industry claims that they're not targeting kids, you know, just look at all these flavors that are available. And you know, we believe that we should take action to start reversing this trend.
And how do the health effects compare to a traditional tobacco product like cigarettes or even chewing tobacco?
Because these products have not been available on the market for as long as cigarettes have, you know, they're still studying these products. The Food and Drug Administration in 2015 extended their authority to begin regulating vaping products as well. Those regulations at the federal level are now delayed, and they were going to look at the effects of these products. So none of these products have been approved for cessation, meaning, or safety, meaning, you know, the health claims that are being made by these products that are helping people to quit, those have not been approved by the FDA. They still have yet to prove that. But in terms of health effects, there's certainly less toxicity in vaping products, but it doesn't make them harmless. There's still components in the e-juice that's not meant to be inhaled, that's not meant to be in the lungs, deposited in the lungs, that can affect, you know, there's health effects such as popcorn lung by certain flavors. But we're also now seeing studies that show that there's a higher risk for stroke, for asthma, and also for COPD when using these products long term.
And as I understand it, they actually have a higher concentration of nicotine than a traditional cigarette has, which is the addictive component of the product. Is that right?
Correct. So this is, if you look at the latest product, they're called Juul. So even kids have come up with the term juuling, which to them, a lot of them don't even think they're using an e-cigarette. They just refer to it as juuling. So Juul is a pod delivery system where a single pod, which is about the size of your thumb, contains as much nicotine as a pack of cigarettes. So that's 26 And anecdotally, we're hearing from our teenagers that they can consume as much as a pod and a half a day. And so you're really looking at the nicotine equivalent of, you know, 1 to 2 packs of cigarettes a day when using these products.
And so that being the case, what regulations or restrictions currently exist either at the federal or the state level to keep some of these products out of the hands of underage kids?
Right. So here in Hawaii, in 2015, the state did raise the age of sale of tobacco products, including electronic smoking devices or vaping products, to 21. So you have to be 21 and over to be able to purchase these products. But there's still an online sales loophole that exists. And so what we're hearing is that, you know, the kids can purchase them online. They can easily bypass the age restriction window when they go to checkout. And in Hawaii, as I mentioned, there's currently no tobacco tax attached to vaping products. There's no marketing restrictions on them. Online sales is still allowed, and of course, flavors only apply to cigarettes. And so the two measures that our youth have been really advocating for is Senate Bill 1405, which would regulate vaping products in the same way as cigarettes and tobacco products, and then Senate Bill 1009, which would end the sale of candy-flavored tobacco products.
And what are the prospects for those bills during this year's legislative session?
Both bills will be heard in the Joint Committee, House Committee, Consumer Protection and Judiciary tomorrow. And then should they pass, they move on to their final House Committee, which is Finance. And so both bills have passed one chamber and have crossed over, and it's, you know, on its way to the remaining committees. There's a lot of support. We have a lot of lawmakers who know that the issue is just, you know, big within their own school districts. They're hearing from their principals and the teachers. You know, the Department of Education has been testifying in strong support, and so it's really a big issue that's consuming not just our teachers, but our parents as well. They really need, we really need to start helping our kids and address this youth vaping epidemic.
That was Trish Lachica, Policy and Advocacy Director for the Public Health Institute of Hawaii. Today's rally at the Capitol is part of the nationwide Kick Butts Day. We'll have a link to those two bills on e-cig sales posted with this story at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Coming up on the next On Point.
Cornbread!
Shot to the head. Left side of the head. Towards rear of the head. How about it?
Hey, somebody,
a young Marine armed with a video camera went to Afghanistan to shoot recruitment videos. He came back with a very different story. His new documentary captures the darker, complex, and messy truth of American Marines at war. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
This afternoon at 2.
Acupuncture, it's a centuries-old Eastern approach to what ails you, but how is it regulated in this modern day and age? Well, that's the subject of our reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Today, Investigations Editor John Hill joins us from their Kaimuki studios. Good morning.
Good morning.
So your headline caught my eye, a long-time acupuncturist who pushed for oversight, now under investigation.
Yeah, and the acupuncturist is Mike Hashimoto. He came to Hawaii from Japan in the 1960s and was instrumental in setting up oversight of acupuncturists for the first time. Up until that time, it had been mostly an underground business in which acupuncturists treated their own ethnic groups and just were word of mouth. People learned about them by word of mouth rather than advertising.
Well, I have to say, I've done acupuncture, but after reading your article, I was thinking, wow, I've been pretty naive. I didn't know a lot about the regulation here, you know, in Hawaii or across the U.S. at all.
Yeah, I mean, there is regulation now. We have, it's evolved a lot since Mike Hashimoto first proposed it in the 1960s. There is oversight, but there are some problems with the way they do it.
Right, and your story brings home a complaint against him.
That's right. He had a patient, a longtime patient in 2016 named Janet Moya, who alleges that he touched her genitals and was testing her sexual response. These are things that would be inappropriate for an acupuncturist. He denies all of these charges. But these charges were made in 2016, so it's almost 3 years ago now.
And so no investigation? No determination one way or the other?
There has not been a determination. There has been an investigation, but it has taken this long. The prosecuting attorney's office, HPD, and the prosecuting attorney's office looked into the charges and decided not to file anything. Then RICO, the Regulated Industries Complaints Office, sort of took over at that point. And one of the problems is that RICO, which investigates all sorts of professionals in Hawaii, from doctors to contractors to acupuncturists, they wait until the prosecuting attorney's office has made a decision about whether to go forward to do their own investigation. So that was one cause of the delay.
So the system that we've got in place, I mean, does it really fall short then in achieving what it's supposed to if we have this case that's kind of outstanding?
I mean, it's the question of justice delayed is not justice. I think it's hard in cases like this on both parties, for the victim who is looking for some sort of resolution and the ability to move on, and also for the practitioner who has this cloud hanging over his head. Now, Dr. Hashimoto was in an unusual case for someone who is accused of this kind of thing, in that he served on the board that makes decisions about people accused of these sorts of things.
Yeah, a little awkward. What's his status?
His status now is that he left the board last fall, and we're told that he left the board because he had hit the 8-year limit for serving on the board, rather than anything to do with the cloud over his conduct, unresolved cloud. We don't know how it will go. One interesting aspect of this case is that the governor's office, which appointed Dr. Hashimoto, did not know about these charges, and they told me they have no mechanism to find out if the people that they have appointed to various regulatory boards have been charged for something like this.
Wow. So not a very good process for vetting.
Yeah. The process for vetting, and also the process for finding out something new about an appointee that they might not hear about. Now, of course, Dr. Hashimoto has the presumption of innocence and due process as a licensee. But when it comes to serving on a board, well, that's a optional sort of honorary thing. And you would think the governor's office might want to know about this kind of charge.
Mm-hmm. And is there anything else you can add just on the number of complaints that we do get against acupuncturists, or how the industry is set up here?
Well, one thing is that struck me when doing the reporting for this story is there has not been an acupuncturist disciplined by the board since 2010. That seems odd. I looked into some other states, and it seemed like there were more frequent administrative actions against the licenses of acupuncturists, so I'm not sure what's going on there.
And then do we have more acupuncturists here than anywhere else?
We don't have more as a raw number, but we have, according to one study that I found, a very recent study, in fact, we have a much, much higher rate, sort of per capita rate of acupuncturists than any other state.
Okay, interesting. All right, thanks so much, John.
Well, thank you.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Honolulu Civil Beat, today featuring editor John Hill. To read the full story, visit civilbeat.org.
I'm Bert Lum. Today on Bite Marks Cafe, we'll find out how a programmable car called Altino is used to introduce students to coding. With computer science becoming a standard in schools across Hawaii, we'll learn how Altino makes the learning experience fun and engaging. That's today at 6:30 p.m. on Bite Marks Cafe.
Well, the island's art scene is vibrant and always in flux. HPR's Noe Tanigawa joins us this morning with details on the Downtown Art Center, which is launching a new gallery and office space in the city's Gateway Plaza.
It's crazy. I know.
Downtown.
What's up, right? The city of Honolulu has made a 1,400 square foot space available on the first floor of the Chinatown Gateway Plaza. You know which one that is, Catherine?
Yeah, that's when they're
the
getting,
pink one.
They're getting heat from, right? About
exactly. That provides an incentive for the city, which is so cool because, okay, big picture. They got this incentive because they used HUD, Housing Urban Development Money, to develop that plaza. And because of the requirements, partly because demand for office space is so low here, they haven't been able to rent out those key spaces. And, I mean, they developed this in 1992. So HUD is asking for their money back, possibly. It could be over $8 million if the city does not get in the kinds of Chinatown redevelopment activities into that building that they promised they would.
Well, I recall that there was a press release. I think the city said they were going to move the satellite city
they
hall
mm-hmm.
down over into that area, which
yep.
makes sense.
It's going into one of those spaces, but that 1,400 square foot space could be the next downtown art center. I mean, that's the idea. And Harrison Rue, community building and TOD administrator for the city, is saying that the Chinatown Action Summit they had a few years ago, it laid out some terrific support for the arts, and the city knows that.
We're hopeful that there can be things going on, you know, afternoon, evenings, and on weekends. There are people doing this stuff already. You see drawing classes out on the streets of Chinatown, people with their painting tripods and folks doing arts tours and taking pictures. And I think the idea is if there's a place that has activities and is open and can do more exhibits and things like that is strongly needed in Chinatown.
Mm-hmm. Well, the idea of a downtown arts center actually could be really far-reaching. I mean, I don't know if you've ever maybe been to the Bangkok Cultural Center or to the, it's called the PMQ Arts Complex in Hong Kong, but like in Hong Kong, it's an old police dormitory that they ripped out this and that, and they have a big central courtyard. They've got cafes, galleries, shops, you know, individual artists, fashion, it's all happening. I mean, these are really destinations for locals as well. And I mean, we've had that kind of excitement for the arts in the past, as charted, for example, by Mark Mitsuda, who's the president of Hawaii Craftsmen.
We had this really huge surge in the craft scene in the 90s and all the way through the mid-90s and maybe into the early 2000s. When the economic downturn happened, I think it really put a damper on the crafts. It was really, really hard for artists and maybe artists in general everywhere. You know, what we're really trying to do is we're trying to go and jumpstart some interest in the crafts again, get people involved by making, and invite people to get their hands dirty.
Do you think, Catherine, possibly somebody might like to do that after work at downtown Honolulu?
Oh, yeah, stress reliever.
Yeah. You know, do I want to jump in my car and immediately join the flow home? Or Mm-mm. do I possibly want to eddy over to right there, the Downtown Arts Center? Could happen. Well, Sydney Lynch with Hawaii Potters Guild. She's been working there for 25 years. She was president. Now she's a treasurer there. This incredible ceramics workshop has been going on since 1967, right there under the freeway by Church of the Crossroads. Sydney says their little band there of potters has noticed the demand for classes is really going up.
Oh, yes. We're oversubscribed, but our space is so limited. It's difficult to find places to do art right now.
Yeah. How does the Potters Guild work?
Oh, it's a co-op. Everybody who comes there is expected to do a certain amount of work in the studio, either make a glaze or clean the bathroom. So we have one part-time employee who does the accounting and is kind of the go-to person in the studio, and everything else is done by volunteers.
And can you imagine that? They've been running this since 1967 this way. That alone is a testament to the kind of community we have here, because it takes honor, it takes commitment, it takes care. And being a part of this community is just one of the things the arts can do. Downtown Chinatown, boy, that'd be great.
Yeah, another place to go for First Friday, huh?
Exactly. And, you know, Hawaii Potters Guild is another one of the terrific, huge, big, strong arts organizations throwing behind this effort. So it's Hawaii Potters Guild, Hawaii Craftsmen, and you know what? Sandy Pohl is the proprietor of Louis Pohl Gallery. Her husband, Louis Pohl, started the Honolulu Museum of Art School, and she's been running all these art experiences in Chinatown for the last 6 years through her nonprofit called Creative Arts Experience, and she's established there is a demand in her area for art services. And she's the one who's been lobbying the city for this opportunity in the Chinatown Gateway Plaza. Have you ever been to Louis Pohl Gallery?
Yes, I have, yeah.
I mean, it's kind of a super experience, right?
It is.
People who come in here, they become my friends because it's just kind of a cool place to hang out. And that's kind of what I want to create over there at the Downtown Art Center, is a really nice place that you feel welcome, that whatever you're feeling that day, you can tell, you know, you can talk stories to people who are around. It's heartwarming. So for me, this gallery is like, it's like my home, you know, and people come and visit. I like that a lot.
She really does make you feel at home there, and she can do the same, I think, in that Downtown Arts Center. The thing is, it's the time to get going on this. Artists and art groups, the Honolulu printmakers are throwing in, and the latest development is they have submitted a request for a 2,800-square-foot space on the second floor, another anchor tenant for this arts, you know, offensive there in Chinatown. Right. Now, printmakers is hedging their bets on that as well, because everybody's wondering, is this community going to come together and do it? The Downtown Art Center pop-up, this trial run, starts this Saturday, March 23rd, 11 to 4, in the Chinatown Gateway Plaza there at the corner of Nu'uanu and Hotel. It's an open house for art lovers and future partners. There'll be printmaking demonstrations and all kinds of stuff.
So interesting synergy that they hope to kind of ignite in that spot.
Exactly. And if you're interested, know other people you can hooey with, neighbor islanders, you are so welcome to get together and claim a month or a space in this development. Check the Hawaii Public Radio website for how to get in touch with Sandy Pohl at the Pohl Gallery.
We'll see what takes shape. Thanks so much, Noe.
Thank you.
That was HPR's Noe Tanigawa with her take on the latest happenings on the culture and art scene.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from UHM Outreach College, presenting classical guitarist Anna Vidovic 2 p.m. this Sunday at UH Orvis Auditorium. outreach.hawaii.edu/community.
Earlier in the program, we shared the story of human footprints fossilized in the desert ash of the Big Island's Ka'u District. During the late 1700s, the Big Island was in a constant state of war, primarily between Kamehameha the Great and Ke'ua Ku'ahu'ula, a high Hawaiian chief. As the story goes, the high chief's army was crossing the summit area of Kilauea on their way to battle. Unfortunately for them, Kilauea volcano erupted. The high chief lost one-third of his army to volcanic gases, and those who were fast enough to run away left footprints that were well-preserved. That's one theory, being because the fine ash from the eruption mixed with rainwater to form a mud that dried quickly in the tropical Hawaiian sun. And left alone over time, these prints remain undiscovered until 1920. Now, Dr. Thomas A. Jagger and his staff of volcanologists were working in the field studying lava flows of the Ka'u District, and usually his crew followed an 8-mile trek around the field. However, one day, staff member Rui Finch hiked across 3 miles of the Keamoku lava field and discovered those prints. There were no winners today. You didn't get that one. We stumped you. But that's today's quiz. If you have an idea for one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Hey, did you know that today officially marks the first day of spring equinox? Well, we dig in on our Hawaii Garden segment to look at the future of orchids. Should we be worried about the decline of the industry? Robert Speer, the president of the Kunia Orchid Society, stopped by our studios to talk up not just one, but two club showings happening this weekend on Oahu.
The Kunia Orchid Society started 65 years. This is our 65th anniversary. They started out in Kunia, of course, the village, and evolved into now we're moved out of the village and into the central Oahu area.
I remember when the plantation shut down out there, Kunia, and I remember going to that show because it was a big deal. It was sentimental, last show out there with those workers at the plantation.
It was so sentimental. It was so much fun just to get a snapshot about the plantation aspect of life and culture in Hawaii. It was fantastic. But you know, things change, and the plantations kind of have declined or gone away. And we were just lucky enough to be able to have one of our founding fathers, so to speak, Kalman Au, arrange to get us into the Leilua High School gym. And we're fortunate because our gym is big enough to be able to really entertain a lot of people. But we're not the only show going on this weekend. The Windward Orchid Society is also going on over in King Intermediate School on the Windward side. And so this is Orchid Lovers Weekend.
Oh, there you go. That's a fun one, too. I've been to that. That's spectacular. Tell us about kind of the state of orchids these days.
Well, the state of orchids is honestly declining. And it's sad to notice, but it's consistent with a lot of the ag industry issues, trying to diversify agriculture. This is just one aspect of that. And 10 years ago, we had 20 or so orchid growers that were in production of orchids to sell. And today, we have between 8 and 10 on Oahu. And honestly, in another 6, 8, or 10 years, there may not be any because all of the growers are just aging, and we're not seeing younger generations come in to take over those businesses. It's very expensive to buy an orchid farm, several million dollars, and try to make that work from an economic sense. It's almost impossible.
There have been challenges in the industry a long time ago on the Big Island. There was a issue with the chemicals that the companies were using, and so it's a struggle.
You're right. That several years ago, maybe a couple of decades ago, that was a chemical called benylate, and that did a lot of harm to a number of the orchids and orchid growers. There was some recovery from that, but now on the Big Island, there are a few orchid producing organizations that will continue on for a while, but you know, almost a third of them got taken out by the volcano, and it's just hard. So if people like orchids, try to come and see them now, because this is a declining industry.
In my neighborhood, there is Kawamoto Orchids in Palolo Valley. They have very unusual orchids. So it's really fun when you go to these different club shows, just, you know, what you'll see.
You're right, and that's really pointed out by this display, is where you'll see literally hundreds of different kinds, whereas the orchid growers that are there for sale won't have nearly as many, much of a variety to be able to buy. But nonetheless, they do have them. Of course, these orchids are available. These orchid producers that we have now sell to Home Depot and all the garden shops. If you see orcas around, they are locally produced. But another aspect of the industry is they're no longer hybridizing hardly any place on any of the islands, but especially on Oahu. There's only one or two that are going to be hybridizing. That means breeding the orcas and bringing them up. You know, when you crossbreed an orchid and you get a little seed pod, there may be a million seeds in there. And every one of those plants are going to be different. But it may take 6 or 8 or 10 years before you see the first bloom on one of those orchids. So that's a long-range program. And now most of the orchid growers are importing the baby plants from Thailand or Taiwan and then growing them up. And so it's kind of a pass-through organization instead of from ground zero all the way up. I've been master gardener for 12 or 13 years, and I've been associated with the College of Tropical Ag and Human Resources at the university, and just watched the agricultural industry as it gone away from sugarcane and pineapple to more attempts towards diversified ag. But one of the foundational parts for the culture in Hawaii is orchids. You know, we know orchids like on the mainland know roses, and we love orchids. And it's just sad for me to have to say that the availability of orchids is probably going to decline as more and more of these businesses go out of business.
Well, you're
going to
make me cry. We have this lovely orchid plant in front of us, you know, beautiful yellow and orange and purple. I mean, it's
Phalaenopsis. Yep.
Fabulous.
Yes. It is beautiful, and this was produced and put together by one of our orchid vendors that will be selling orchids at our show this coming weekend. And they just do a marvelous thing. They are one of the bigger, maybe the biggest local current producers of orchids on Oahu. And they do maybe 1,000 plants a week to all the little shops and so forth. Very, very, S&W Orchids is really our outstanding folks to work with. They produce really nice plants, and I have to say, I agree.
It's a beautiful specimen. Now, I know, too, that there are a number of nurseries throughout the island, and it is really nice to kind of go back, you know, where they're actually growing these.
You're right, and I had the opportunity just 2 weeks ago to go out to Waianae to visit 6 different orchid producers and see how they're doing and so forth, and they're all... almost all of them are just declining. Many of them have only half of their shade houses have orchids, and they're to the point to say, "Well, you know, I'm going to retire. I want to sell my place." But there just are not a plethora of people anxiously waiting to buy an orchid farm.
It's okay, so we're looking for people out there with a passion for orchids.
Yeah, so the orchid producers, that's the downside. The positive side is there's still lots of little backyard growers like me. I've got a couple hundred orchids, and I fiddle with them, and I like them and try them and so forth, and I can do some with better than others. But there's lots of those kind of backyard growers that are still available and do sell at some of our shows. But the volume and opportunity for the bigger growers is going to decline.
Kind of a sorry state we're in.
It's a sorry state for a beautiful plant, beautiful part. I wish there was some way to be able to, I wish there was some magic we could say, okay, this land, these places are all free, and you don't, but we don't have that opportunity.
Right, and it's a challenge to grow because we've seen what's happened with our weather. And a lot of nurseries often, you know, suffer damage with the winds, you know, or like you said, on the Big Island, Mother Nature with the fog, and, you know, plants get burned. Neighbor islands, Maui and Kauai, they've had the issues also with the flooding. So you're in harm's way. You're in trouble.
Well, if you're in agriculture in any way, those environmental challenges always come along, and that doesn't help. Any industry, much less the orchid industry. You're right. Exactly right.
Okay, so folks then can look forward to this weekend, not just the Kunia show, but also the one on the Windward side.
Windward Orchid Society show at King Intermediate. And I'll be at this show here in up in Leilua High School. I'll be there every day. If someone stops in and says hi to me, I'll show him around the plants and give him a little bit of word about how wonderful it is. And I have to say that our group, we have 23 different committees who are working to put this. Almost 100 people have been working for the last two or three months to put this thing. This is a big project. And I really am proud of all the things that our folks have done to do this. They love orchids. That's why they're here. And we want to help spread that. Our mission is public education on orchids.
Okay, so you can make this an orchid kind of weekend, go around the island and pick up your orchids.
Exactly, yes.
Anything else you want to add just about the neighbor islands at all?
The Big Island is the biggest, as far as orchids go, the biggest producer of orchids, bigger than Oahu. But they're also pass-through, where they bring in small plants and grow them up for a year or two and then sell them from that viewpoint. There are a few that are hybridizing, but that's declining, as I mentioned. There's only two or three significant orchid growers in the production aspect on Maui. And I'm not familiar with Kauai, but there aren't very many there.
Okay,
either.
All right. So really the clubs are the lifeline, and that these kinds of shows bring the people out.
Clubs will be a critically important aspect to continue the public education and enjoyment of orchids as time goes forward. Absolutely right.
The Kunia Orchid Show and Plant Sale begins Friday from 9 to 5 at Lelihu High School. It also continues Saturday and on Sunday with 11 vendors and 8 displays by members of various orchid societies. And the Windward Oahu Spring Orchid Show is marking its 39th year. It also runs Friday to Sunday.
Hey folks, Al Letson here, and riddle me this. What do Roseanne Barr, the Trump presidential campaign, fake news sites run by Macedonian teenagers, and Russian Twitter accounts all have in common?
Pizzagate.
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 That's next time on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
This evening at 7.
That's it for today. Up tomorrow, we continue Talking Story with Hawaii's mayors. Tomorrow, we get to know Maui Mayor Mike Victorino. Call in with your questions. Tell us what you think or suggest a story idea. Contact our TalkBack line, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Be back tomorrow with more of the conversation.